If one can really grow in the knowledge of the fact that mankind is but one, expressing itself in terms of innumerable units, each one of which displays variety, then the possibility of violence against anybody is considerably removed. If I am constantly aware that you, the unique you, and myself are two beings who are not a separate two, but are completely interrelated, then it becomes impossible for me to hate you or bear resentment or malice or ill will. Because that would be the same as hating or resenting myself. This has to be not merely a thought, an idea. If it is merely an idea, it is not a living reality in me. And if it is not a living reality, it is ineffectual. If we really see this, we will understand how and why millions of human beings who profess brotherhood, who profess living by the teaching of compassion or of love, whatever word you like, never succeed in loving. They are separate. This isolative self-consciousness is so strong that it injects this poison of division between oneself and every person in the world, including those whom we say are so near and dear to us. Not only between oneself and every person, but between oneself and every living thing and every single object in the world. There is this separation because of this isolative self-consciousness. I am different. I am separate. I am unawake to the fact of existence, that all existence is one existence. I bring this up today because, as you all know only too well, the world is sliding into more and more terrible divisiveness with all its complications, its problems, with all the dis-ease and the pain and the sorrow and the destructiveness associated with it. And our tendency always is to rush in order to do this, that, or the other about it. To do this, that, or the other externally as a technique, a procedure which will set right. No external procedure will ever set right. Why? We are living organisms, and we live from within ourselves. It's the power of life from within ourselves which throws out the manifestation of that living energy outwards. If this living center is poisoned at its very root, then everything that I project out of myself is going to be poisoned likewise. To rush about doing this, that and the other in this external sense, this mechanical sense, is the activity of the ignorant, the incapable. I don't mean ignorant in simply the intellectual sense, but in a very much profounder sense. Our darkness, our ignorance, is right within our own consciousness. And here I'm using the word consciousness in its fullest denotation and connotation, to include what we commonly call the conscious as well as the unconscious or subconscious or whatever you like. Consciousness in its own inner reality is something transcendent. It's indefinable. It is unlimited. It is not particular. It is beyond the clutches of the senses. Now, when the mind is quiet, when the senses are pacified, this inner awareness, which is the transcendent reality functioning through the outward organism, begins to shine unhindered. The opacity of our particular desires, our thoughts, our ideas, our experience, our memories, and all the rest of it is out. Because in that pacified state, everything is crystal clear. One has to experience this kind of thing. Let the silence envelop oneself. If I struggle to enter the silence, there will only be a noise. But if I just let the silence seep in, then all this which is at present noise will be a harmonious sound contained within that indescribable silence. And that silence is infinite. And my little harmony through my quietness is the little music that is, shall I say, the key signature, this particular key signature of that transcendent silence. What happens? Oneself, the individual, is in the truly human state then. Because oneself, the individual, is in the truly human state, this infinite power, this infinite reality, functions freely and unhindered through that individual as a focus point and affects the totality. Don't ask for proof of this. It is as futile to ask for proof of this and as absurd to attempt to give proof of this as it is futile and absurd to ask for the proofs or to submit the proofs of the existence of God. Truth in the religious context, in the context of the transcendent, has no truck, no dealings with what we commonly call proof. Proof is demanded by the mind which is suffering from noise, from turmoil. And it demands proof of this, that, or the other idea in the pathetic belief that that proof will heal the pain of the mind, will clear its confusion. Nothing of the sort happens. We stumble from one disastrous condition into another disastrous condition. But if we let go, be at ease and quiet, then this transcendent dimension of being and consciousness affects the healing. And in effecting this healing, it brings about one extraordinary result amongst other extraordinary results. It clears out of our psychophysical being all the unconscious self-seeking self-orientation, all the unconscious bondage to the duals, to the opposites which constitute duality. If you question or just talk with people who are sincerely, seriously devoted to living the religious life, you will find that their questions are couched in a form which shows at once that their minds are still completely caught up in the evaluations, criteria, judgments, values of duality. You will find questions coming up which concern progressing or regressing, which concern solving this problem or bringing about a desirable result or getting free of the bondage of desire or passion or whatever it is. transcendence is all inclusive. There is nothing excluded. Even existence as we see it in the universe is all inclusive. The very word universe, we don't call it a multiverse. The very word universe, quite rightly, exemplifies the unity of all existence. Language is a wonderful thing. When language emerges in any particular race, out of the inner depths, the right sounds somehow come into being to express truth. It's most extraordinary. Language, insofar as it emerges out of our living being, from the depths and from the power of life within ourselves, language expresses truth. It is a live thing. But you can make an artificial language, and then we descend into absurdity, into mechanizing life, into fragmenting it, into producing all the situations and conditions for discord and disunity. If we are concerned with the religious life, we need not be perturbed about it. The universe is still slightly stronger than I am. After all the noise I make and the trouble I create, it will one day say, "Come along, old boy, I'll take you in." And that's the finish of the old boy. It's as sweet and charming as that. For there's no cause for being disturbed. What is it that makes me disturbed fundamentally? The egoism in me. I've got to do something about it. Otherwise, goodness knows what will happen. Yes, goodness does know what will happen. I don't. That is why the foolish me rushes about making a little absurd show. See, this inner quietness is the most perfect activity of the true human. All the other actions, as we commonly call them, which emerge out of the true human, are perfect actions. Perfect by no worldly criterion whatsoever, but perfect because they are the inevitable expression of that which is transcendent. Under those particular circumstances. But the shape of those actions will be subject to the shape of the whole of this psychophysical being which goes by my name. I don't mean the shape of this body. But the shape of my seeing, my hearing, my touching, my tasting, my feeling, my thinking. All this has its rupa, its shape. All this has its informing principle. It's informing in the sense of not giving information, but its energizing principle, nama, the name as it is called. Look carefully into the Upanishad, into the Upanishads. There's one extraordinary conversation in which the Holy One is asked, when this body dies and all is disintegrated, what is it that remains? And the Holy One answers, nama, the name. Endless verily is the name. Does that mean that the name Horatio Nelson or Winston Churchill is the thing that lives forever? Not a bit of it. This energizing principle, this mysterious infinite power. And it is given to man on this planet. It is given to us who have been brought forth by Mother Earth and Father Sun, and so constituted that at last in us is that extraordinary possibility for the emergence of the transcendent. The power which we have for looking within ourselves and recognizing unique selfness has been and is misused by mankind century after century. I say misused because this power of looking within has made human beings utilize the tremendous energy generated thereby for their self-aggrandizement. We play when we are little children, I am the king of the castle. And when it happens that we do not outgrow, I am the king of the castle, when the body has reached adulthood, we become the Napoleons and the Hitlers and the whatnot of the world. The miserable destroyers who strut on the world stage. That is just to give the exceptional examples. But perhaps you and I, nice people that we are, in our little way, in our little sphere, occasionally indulge in that. Do we? Don't we? It's so difficult to see into this. Our awareness, our consciousness, is still held within the bounds of duality. We are not free from separative, from isolative self-consciousness. The moment we orient anything to ourself, we go through a process by which we cut ourselves off from complete relationship with totality, the one total reality. That is the basic sin, the basic trouble. Now we cannot heal that If we approach it in terms of solving the problem of selfishness and egoism and vanity and greed and hate, by trying to counteract what the intellect calls evil. And it calls it evil, not wrongly, of course not wrongly. But in calling it evil and in wanting to counteract it, this inner thing in us, which should be free and open, is closed within the bounds of the conflicting duals. What we call evil can never and is never destroyed in the sense of annihilated. It can only be transformed. Every scientist knows this fact in his own way. We postulate the law of the conservation of mass and energy. Nothing can be annihilated. What is, is. It can only be transformed. That is it. And where we humans make our mistake is in thinking of this transformation as a transformation of shape. No. For us humans, it is a transformation of the manner in which we are aware of existence. When that transformation of the manner in which we are aware of existence takes place, all the shapes that naturally flow out of this living being are the right shapes. But if this person, oneself, who is in the state of sin, in the state of ignorance, in the state of confusion, of incapacity, but to tinker about with the shapes, he will only make ugly shapes. He'll exchange one ugly shape for another. It's very difficult to see this, you know. Our whole conditioning, the heritage of our whole race and our physical evolution itself does not quite help us. It all tends to confine us within the sphere of the conflict of the duals. Now, don't try to get out of the conflict of the duals. I know perfectly well. Each person has his own suffering, his own problems. The way fate, circumstance batters this person seems to be unjustly helpful to that person, and so forth. But if one were to see it from the limited sphere of duality, all that one can do is just to be sentimentally consolatory, not truly compassionate, creatively compassionate. I know that there is the fact of this ill state, as we call it, this suffering, this misery, this pain. The appearance of the whole universe in itself, existence, a standing out of, ex sistere, its Latin derivation, this standing out of the transcendent is a pain upon the transcendent, so to say. The totality of existence is a pain. It's a tumor. It's a swelling. You can't solve that by this petty little brain and all its schemes, like the schemes of mice and men. You can't solve it by false acceptance, by spineless resignation, by saying we must put a bold face upon it and somehow mug along. Haven't we mugged along long enough? And where are we? More mugging. Not that way. Nor can we approach it rightly by saying, I shall give my whole self, my whole being, dedicate all my activities and everything to the Lord. He will guide me. Or to the enlightened one, to the sage, to the holy one who lives here or there or wherever it is. You see, in all those procedures, I am just throwing off my own shoulders my own responsibility. I am trying to externalize that which can never be externalized, namely my own living being. My own living being is always just here. If I am really awake to my own living being, which I call I, and which 3,500 million others call you, if I fully awake to this living being here, I have fully awakened to 3,500 million yous. I am free of this illusion of separateness between thou and I, whether the thou be just a human being or whether it be eternal God. So there is no possibility of escape from sorrow or suffering. You and I can try to cheat the immanence, which is the transcendence embodied in this living creature. You and I can try to cheat it. But all that happens is that I receive the wages of sin in that cheating. The wages of sin, which is death. Mere disruption, an ignoble ending, a damp squib, a firework which never scattered a magnificent shower of brilliant stars. So you see, it always comes back upon what we call oneself. And we have to remember that oneself is no permanent, unchanging entity. It's very hard to see this. Out of fear and egoism, primarily, we cling hard to this tumor of the mind, I, the immortal, this conceived I, this I which is just a fantasy of the brain, is no reality. Whatsoever we want as a permanent, unchanging entity is a lie against the truth of existence. And the truth of existence is the continuously changing. A continuously changing and transforming manifestation of that which cannot be seen, touched, heard, tasted, smelt, measured, defined, or anything like that. If these remain as mere ideas, you can just as well throw them into the waste paper basket. But if the inner awareness, the inner consciousness, in the complete quietude of the mind and the body, just becomes aware, this is so. If that happens, that is liberation, that is salvation. And the purpose of appearance, of manifestation, is fulfilled. And you and I need never ask what is the purpose and define it. Sweet are the ways of the divine. And there are many signs and wonders in the world to show that sweetness. Look at the blossoming of the flower. The magnificence of a brilliant dawn, or the mellow sweetness of a lovely sunset, fading glory, a fading glory, fading from sight, but that essential indefinable thing which is the glory is the immortal thing which doesn't fade. And you are aware of it in the quietness. When this clamor for the separate I is out. Now you see, one must relate all this to one's everyday action, thought, feeling, procedure. When you're baking your bread, when you're putting on your tie, when you're catching the bus or driving your car, or signing a check for 3 pence or £3 million, as the case may be. Be aware of it. Awake to it. When you are in pain, emotional pain, intellectual pain, the physical pain of illness, don't be resigned to it, don't fight against it, don't indulge in it, don't wallow in it. Awake, awake to it. Don't evaluate it, but this is a regression, this is backward, this ought not to be. Am I still such a stupidly conceited person as to tell this infinite reality what ought to be? How dare I? Have I not learned through my long life that what is commonly called frustration, sorrow, suffering, makes the immortal flower which is embodied within one's own being bloom more wonderfully than what we call success and achievement. I have certainly learned that. And when you learn that, you get completely free of caring for the wrong things. You also get free of this vested interest caring for the good things and the right things. And this is the more difficult task. Remember those marvelous words of that martyr mystic, Marguerite Poretti, who was burned at the stake in 1310. In that marvelous book of hers, The Mirror for Simple Souls, "Virtues, I take leave of you." You see, when a person has arrived at the stage where he or she can take leave of the virtues, but in his or her everyday life is the very light of virtuous living, then that person is the one who is utterly free of all selfness. Because it is no longer that person who is virtuous, it is virtue itself shining through this living organism, which no longer hinders truth, reality, in the transcendent sense. So you see, whatever discipline draws us and attracts us, whether it be a contemplative discipline of this order or that order, whether we call it yoga, whether we call it this, that or the other, whatever it may be, whatever discipline draws us and attracts us, remember that at the heart of that discipline there is one supreme thing which has to be brought out, brought to fruition: the dissolution of all selfness. And do remember, this dissolution is not the casting aside of an idea, of a thought, but of the actual fact and reality of selfness, which is the mighty dark within our own being obstructing the light. Our whole inner consciousness. Now if you understand this, you will really understand the significance of that word mindfulness, which we have in Buddhism so strongly emphasized. Samasati, perfect mindfulness. You will understand the tremendous, the omnipotent significance of Jesus' words, watch and pray. Watch. Only man can watch. The flower is, the cat on the hearthrug is, the stars in the skies are. But only man can watch. You see, out of the transcendent reality came forth this appearance, the universe. Self-unknowing, Only when this universe produced this creature called man, this self-knowingness was able to come into existence, come into manifestation. Self-knowingness. And the first thing we do with self-knowingness is to misuse it for self-purposes. But when we have seen through that and handed over, so to say, the fruit brought as our sacrifice to the altar of eternal God, handed over the fruit of the whole process of freeing ourselves from selfness through self-knowingness and relating it rightly to the totality, one of the supreme purposes of all existence, this which has emerged out of transcendence, is fulfilled. If you like, you can regard this sort of thing as one of the purposes of man's existence in the globe. You may remember some weeks ago, I put it in slightly different terms. We talked about Akasha, this order of energy which is dimensionless, immeasurable. This order of energy which belongs to the realm which some have called pure mind or mind only. And then there is this universe, the appearance, in which energy is the measurable, the particular. You and I can control it. But the energy of Akasha is a mystery. It rules us. It is God, if you like to use that word, determining man's life without predetermination in the sense that we understand determination or predetermination. This is an extraordinary mystery. And each single pattern, we'll confine ourselves just to man, each single pattern, living pattern, man, is a vessel through whom that extraordinary, dimensionless, unknown, and unknowable energy works some marvelous purpose. Insofar as you and I, each one of us, can be truly watchful, truly mindful, truly awakened, truly in communion, samadhi, the perfect communion, that's what samadhi ultimately is. Sang adhi, adhi the supreme, sang togetherness. Any etymologist will laugh at me and say, for goodness sake, don't listen to that fellow, he knows nothing of what he's talking about. Of course I don't. But this is the truth, nevertheless, about samadhi. When these two are there together like that, then that mystery of Akasha is fulfilled through the living being. You see, these things cannot be argued about, obviously. You can't intellectualize about it. There's no possibility of giving proofs or any such thing. Or perhaps if there is, well, I am uninterested in it, in giving proofs. One sees certain things, finally. That is to say, something happens. And then, if there is the sort of partly the inborn natural capacity, the gift which has been cultivated, this can be cultivated, a particular gift which one has, painter, poet, or whatever it is, you see. And if that is the case, then that person can say the word, can speak the word. But that person who speaks the word must always remember that that word is not, has no finality about it, has no authority in that rigid, absurd sense. That word emerges here and now because all of us are here in a togetherness, in a communion. And if one can thrill to that togetherness and communion, one has released something at least of the transcendent reality of love into the world atmosphere. These are great mysteries. And yet, in the actual experiencing and realizing, the mystery is completely open. And yet, although so completely open, it completely defies being limited into any permanent form. So one must remember that the word, the spoken word, the written word, is only an influence for the time being. It is a temporal influence only. If that were not the case, the words of one Holy One on the globe would be sufficient for all time over the globe. But it isn't. And it never can be. The word is the shape which goes out. It can be as food which one eats. But what happens to the food you eat? That food as such has disappeared completely. Once you've eaten that apple's gone out of existence altogether as an apple. It is you now. And then it doesn't stay inside you. The whole of you is constantly going out also. We must realize this. And if we are really awake to it, within this mortal coil, we shall be awake to the nature of immortality. Within this appearance, which is a dukkha, a suffering, so to say, a pain on the transcendent, there'll be the realization of that eternal bliss that lies at the heart of everything.